This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking with novelist Neil Gaiman. His writing has won him critical acclaim, a number of awards, and also many loyal fans. People perhaps will know him for his novels American Gods, Neverwhere, and Stardust. That book won the American Library Association's Alex Award as one of the best adult novels for young adults in the year 2000. He also published a collection of short fiction titled Smoke and Mirrors and a picture book for children titled The Day I Swapped My Dad for Two Goldfish. He is also the author of the Sandman series of graphic novels and has won a number of awards, including the World Fantasy Award and the Bram Stoker Award. Today, in this hour of focus, we will be talking about his most recent book, and it is his first novel for young readers. The title of the book is Coraline, and it is published by HarperCollins. He says that he started it actually some years back as a story for his daughter. He says that he wanted it to feature a girl as the main character and also wanted it to be refreshingly creepy, and it is. As we talk this morning, of course, your questions and comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois or Indiana. Or if you happen to be listening on the Internet and you're somewhere in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you're welcome to call. Mr. Gaiman, hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time.
You are quite welcome.
I also read that you have said of this book, Coraline, that it's the strangest book that you have written.
Oh, I think so, yes. I mean, it's about 30,000 words long, which is, what, about one-tenth the length of my last novel, American Gods. So it's a very short book, and it took me 10 years to write. And it's very strange and very spooky, and I wrote it in an incredibly unprofessional way for a writer, because whenever I didn't know what happened next, I'd just stop until I did.
Hmm.
And sometimes that would take up to 4 or 5 years, and then I'd suddenly go, I know what happens next, and I'd write the next few pages.
So I understand that this did indeed start out as a story for your daughter, who was then 5, and she is now 17?
She's just turned 17, yes. I wound up finishing it, started it for her. She was a wonderful sort of 5-year-old, of the kind who, she was one of those little Wednesday Addams girls.
Hmm.
You know, she'd come home from school, and she'd see me writing, and she'd come and sit on my lap and make me open a new screen on the computer and dictate a story, which would normally involve small girls hiding from witches who would lock them in rooms and stand outside the doors gloating at them and occasionally disguising themselves as their parents. So when I came to write a story for Holly, I thought, well, I'll write one of those kind of things for her. And unfortunately, of course, because I was writing it in my own time and nobody was waiting for it, it took me a very long time to write.
So that would explain the fact that she inspired it and it was the kind of story that she liked, would explain the fact that the lead character is a girl.
Oh, completely, yes. Although I've been delighted recently by the fact that boys are reading it. We're getting very puzzled reviews and puzzled and delighted feedback from teachers and shop owners saying that, yes, we're getting boys in. I suppose the boys don't mind it because it's spooky, because there's something a little bit scary and a little bit out of the ordinary. They don't mind the fact that they're reading about a girl. As a kid, I never minded. I always loved the fact that Alice in Alice in Wonderland was, you know, primarily a person. I didn't think of it as a girl's book anymore, and my favorite character in the Narnia books was always Lucy. So, it seemed very natural writing a book with a girl as a lead character.
There is an essay on your website that's, I believe it's titled, All Books Have Genders. Or perhaps that's the subject is that all books have genders. I wonder what that means.
Well, I suppose to some extent it was a way of trying to make sense. It just started out as on my website I keep a journal, and this started out as an entry on the journal, and it just grew out of hand, and all of a sudden I realized I'd written 2,000 words, and I thought that's much too long to be a journal entry, so I shoved it aside. But it was trying to explain why some books and some stories seem to be very female, and some of the ones I write seem to be very male, and where the focus is on the characters. I mean, this is, Coraline is definitely female as a book. I tend to think of it as her. I mean, think of the book as a she. And almost all of the characters in it are female. I mean, we have Coraline. We have her mother. Her father is slightly shadowy. We have two wonderful, mad old ladies living downstairs who used to be former actresses. They're now in their 80s, and one of them is devoted to trying to get them back onto the stage. And then we have, of course, much more sinister and much stranger, Coraline's other mother, or the person who calls herself Coraline's other mother, who Coraline meets and encounters and rapidly learns that she's going to have to outsmart.
What about the cat? Is the cat male or female?
Oh, the cat's definitely a boy.
Oh, okay. Now, that's interesting because I guess I would have thought so too, but I'm not sure why.
I have no idea why either. But it's, the cat is a very male presence in the book and magnificently sarcastic. I can't help feeling if it had been a female cat, she might not have been quite so sarcastic.
Hmm. Well, I think that you've done a pretty good job capturing the essence of cat. And I say this as someone who has had cats live under my roof. I won't say that I had them. No one ever does. But I have lived with some, and I think that you've done a pretty good job.
Well, I try to get that difference between cats and dogs. You know, I sometimes when I write, I have a little cabin that I go out to write, and the caretaker of the cabin has a dog, and the dog will come in, and he'll lie at my feet while I'm writing, and you can see him looking up at me with these eyes that go, I don't know what you're writing, but I bet it's brilliant. I bet it's wonderful. I bet you'll win awards for it. I bet it's just wonderful. And then if I'm typing and a cat comes by, the cat will just sort of sit there and they'll look at the screen for a moment, and you can see them thinking, he doesn't know how to use a semicolon. And then they go away again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The story, we should perhaps sketch out a little bit of the story, and we'll try and I want to give people a sense of the story, but certainly don't want to
give them too much.
But it is indeed the story of a girl, Coraline, and I understand that the name actually started as a typo, and you decided to keep it.
It did. I actually discovered I'd been writing a letter a few days before I started the book to somebody named Caroline, and I got the O and the A confused while I was typing, and I thought, whoa. I like that. What a beautiful name. And it means like coral. And you get all sorts of images of beauty and hardness involved. And I really like that. And more recently, I was looking on eBay, and I found sheet music for a song called Coraline.
Hmm.
So I sent off for it. And it came from the 1880s. And it seems to have been my darling Clementine sort of knockoff from that period about, you know, somebody falling in love with a girl who died. And at that point, it's all sort of, she would walk among the flowers, she looked just like a queen. I'd stand with her for hours, my darling Coraline. So it obviously was a name, and I mispronounced it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's too late now, really, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
So the story of Coraline is about a girl, and she's moved into a big old house, and she's actually moved into an apartment in a big old house. The house has been broken up, and her mother and father start living there, and she's fascinated by the fact that in one room of the house, they have two doors. They have a door that you go in and out by, and another door in the wall, which, if you open it up, because the house was an irregular shape when it was converted into apartments, you open up this one door, it will open onto a brick wall. And the brick wall fascinates Caroline. And one day, when there's nobody around, she goes and she opens the door, and this time it doesn't open onto a brick wall. This time it opens onto a corridor. And she goes down the corridor, and she finds herself in a place that's very much like the apartment she just left. Only waiting for her in the kitchen is a woman who looks just like her mother, only she's taller and she's paler. And she has fingers that never stop moving. And she has big black buttons for eyes. And she claims to be Coraline's other mother. And at first, Coraline is absolutely delighted. Everything in this place, everyone pays so much more attention to her. It's so much more interesting and wonderful than the rather boring place she left. But after a while, she realizes this is not necessarily a good thing. And I'm not going to tell you anything else.
I like also the description of the other mother's hair as described as gently swaying, sort of like grass underwater.
Yes.
I like that very much.
I loved writing the other mother. I mean, it was really fun to write a monster and to write a really, you know, quite genuinely scary monster for children. And suddenly, it made the story work so much better. I was in Ireland last week doing a signing tour, and I went to Ireland on a day when they just found the body of two little girls who'd been murdered in England. And the Irish were asking me, I thought very interesting questions, because nobody was asking, why did you write a book for children that's got some dark stuff in it? Instead, they were asking, why did we take out the dark stuff? Why did we go over exclusively to Barney fiction? Why did we forget to tell children there are monsters out there? Which I thought was a fascinating attitude, a very, very strange and interesting shift in perception.
Well, it's interesting that you, when you were talking about how this book was born, really, it had a lot to do with the fact that you had a daughter who liked stories about little girls who were pursued by witches. Sometimes they would disguise themselves as their parents. They would lock them in closets, and some things sort of like that happen in this book. But given that people seem these days, some people seem to be very concerned about this kind of, this genre and its effect on children, how do you, or do you, think about the line between what is too much for a young reader and what is appropriate?
I think on the whole, kids tend to self-select. We intentionally made the cover of Caroline a little bit creepy. It shows a girl holding a candle and these sort of ghostly hands reaching out for her, little ghostly rats coming after her. If a child is going to be scared by the cover, then they probably shouldn't read the book. On the other hand, when you stop and think back over the stories that we were told, and you actually take them apart as an adult, they can be completely horrifying. Hansel and Gretel. Do you remember? Did anyone tell you the story of Hansel and Gretel, David?
I don't know if it was told to me. I'm sure that I read it at some point.
Encountered it at some point.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, let's strip down the story of Hansel and Gretel to its ingredients. You have a famine going on in a land. You have two parents who decide that they don't have enough food, given the famine, to feed themselves and their children. So they resolve to take their children out into the forest and abandon them, which they do. They leave their children in the forest. The children think themselves initially rescued by an old woman who offers to feed them and stuff, only to discover that she is a cannibal. She imprisons the boy, Hansel, and starts to fatten him up in order to cook him, and is only defeated when the girl gets smart and pushes her into an oven and burns her to death. And you look at that story and you go, my, how can we tell kids such stories of such appalling horribleness? But there are really good lessons to be learned from that, including straightforward ones like people who seem to mean you well may not, including very uncomfortable ones, which also wind up very often true, such as your parents' agenda may not necessarily be yours. And probably the biggest of all of them, which is, you know, seize your opportunity. There's a quote at the beginning of Caroline, which I took from the writer and thinker and theologian, G.K. Chesterton, where he says, fairy tales are not true, fairy tales are more than true, not because they tell us that dragons exist, but because they tell us that dragons can be beaten. And as far as I'm concerned, as long as that's the lesson that you're telling kids, you're probably fine.
I was, I don't necessarily want to discourage anyone from the book, but I was particularly struck. I was looking at the Amazon website where they encourage people who have, you know, they encourage people who have read particular books to write in and tell them what they thought. And one of the reviews here came from an unidentified 11-year-old reader.
I think that somebody, reading that one, somebody claiming to be an unidentified
reader. You're suspicious?
Much more suspicious.
You're suspicious. Well, what the...
I've seen a lot of reviews from kids, and none of them say that kind of thing.
Oh. Well, the person, whoever this is, the person who claims to be the 11-year-old reader says, quote, "This book starts off very interesting from the very first page, but I kind of wish I didn't read all the other pages. There are things from it I don't want to have in my head."
Yeah, and I got to say, that doesn't sound like an 11-year-old.
You don't?
From the first page, but I wish I hadn't read all the other pages. That's a 30-year-old writer.
The writer then goes on to praise Lemony Snicket, so maybe it's him. I don't know.
No, I don't think that will be Daniel. He's too busy.
Don't think so. All right.
But no, I mean, I think that's just one of the troubles with Amazon, which is you get these bizarre reviews that anybody can write claiming to be anything.
True enough.
I mean, there are lots. The reviews that I've been reading on a lot of the places where kids actually get to review books are very funny because all of them tend to say, I really like this book, but I thought it was a little bit too childish for me. But maybe, you know, there wasn't any, no, I haven't seen any reviews yet from kids complaining about it being horrible or scary.
Well, I think...
I've seen reviews from adults complaining that it gave them nightmares. I've had adults come up and tell me that they got halfway through the book and went around the house turning on all the lights, and that they've had horrible nightmares of people with button eyes pursuing them. So I know that I'm definitely traumatizing a fair number of adults. But so far the kids, and I've been on tour and talking to a lot of them, have been saying things like, I say, do you know, was it scary? And they say no. They say, my mum was scared when she was reading it to me. And then they'll just tell me their favorite bits.
I was interested to read that apparently the first publisher or editor you showed it to said, well, I like this book, but I'm not sure that it can be published because I'm not sure that it's that it might be too grown up for children, but adults wouldn't want to read it because they would see it as a children's book. And it seems obviously you've actually managed to capture a lot of both.
Well, I mean, I'm very, very fortunate. You mentioned Lemony Snicket earlier on. And of course we have Philip Pullman and queen of them all, J.K. Rowling. And we, you know, that publisher I showed it to was in 1991, and he was completely right. I mean, it was absolutely impossible to publish a book in 1991 which would have been aimed at both children and adults, and which could be, you know, could crop up on some adult bestseller lists and on some children's bestseller lists. But I think that, things have changed. Harry Potter was the big thing that changed it, because suddenly the stigma of reading children's books was removed from adults. And that was followed up by Philip Pullman. And bless him now, Lemony Snicket, who, started out with kids reading the books and then they've infected the adults, which I think is just wonderful.
We have a caller, and I would take them into the conversation, bring him in here just a moment. I do want to introduce again, though, our guest. We're speaking this morning with Neil Gaiman. Some people, I'm sure, will know him for his novels, American Gods, Neverwhere, Stardust. They have been well received by reviewers and by readers and have sold very well. He has also published a collection of short fiction, Smoke and Mirrors, a children's picture book titled The Day I Swapped My Dad for Two Goldfish. He's the author of the Sandman series of graphic novels, and his most recent is a novel for, well, could be for anyone, young readers perhaps, or a little bit older ones. The title is Coraline, and it's published by HarperCollins, and it's out now. It just came out in July, and we're happy to have him with us this morning to talk about it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Champaign on line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hi, Neil. I was fortunate enough to get my American Gods signed by you out at Pages for All Ages a couple of years ago.
Oh, brilliant.
And I wanted to speak to the point that you made about Hansel and Gretel. I have been a student of mythology and fairy tales for a very, very long time, and it's my opinion that the darker fairy tales that I grew up with were a way of transmitting ethic and moral from the older generation to the younger generation, and it makes me very angry to see how these have been sugarcoated by a certain corporation in this country for children's use, and I'd like you to speak to that if you could.
Well, I think that I think you've got a real point that the biggest thing is that a lot of these stories have become ways of talking about the big issues.
Yes.
Which I would say include things like good and evil and life and death. This is how it's a way of talking about them to kids. I think that things definitely over the last 30 or 40 years, we've been softer and softer and gentler in what we feel it's appropriate to show kids. And I think one is actually doing them a disservice.
Yes.
By giving them fiction which only reflects an impossibly hospitable world.
Yes.
Because I think the world is actually a really good and a really interesting place, but it's not always hospitable. And that's one of the things you learn from your fairy tales. I think Disney definitely started off very well.
Yes.
The original Disney Snow White, I actually think is very powerful. And one of the reasons it's so powerful and so memorable is the Wicked Queen.
Yes.
Who is an absolutely magnificent villain, and her defeat is a very good one.
I found that in The Little Mermaid, as I recall, the Christian Andersen original tale, not only did The Little Mermaid trade her voice for legs, but I believe Andersen stated very specifically that every step she took was as though there was a knife going up her legs.
Well, I think the great thing, I mean, yes, that's true, and The Little Mermaid is a heartbreaking story,
yes.
The original one. I almost find myself here wanting to defend the Disney one at this point because I go, well, the nice thing about the great stories is they don't go away. You can make the Disney versions. You can sanitize them. In the Disney version of Sleeping Beauty, she doesn't sleep for 100 years.
No.
She actually sleeps, I think, for roughly three quarters of an hour.
while
magical vines grow up and the prince rides up, defeats the Maleficent and wakes her with a kiss, and it's all over by it's the same afternoon. But people don't tell each other that story. If you are told or read a version of The Sleeping Beauty, it's going to be 100 years because that's what makes it a wonderful story, is that long period of time. So I think stories survive Disney. And I think just the fact that kids need...
I worry that the children that see these only in movie form may never actually read the original.
I think that's true. And I think that's very unfortunate. And I also think that a lot of it is the responsibility of parents. Parents should tell stories.
Absolutely.
And there are some terrific collections of fairy tales and folk tales out there if parents don't feel comfortable just improvising and going into it. But I think oral storytelling as well as reading to kids is incredibly important.
I agree, absolutely. It's so wonderful to hear you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for the call. Others are certainly welcome to call 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And our guest is novelist Neil Gaiman. You talked about the sort of set up the story a little bit about the girl who moves into the new apartment that is part of a big house that had been divided into apartments, and she finds a door that initially, when it's open, there's a brick wall behind, and then the next time there's another apartment that's something of a strange mirror image of hers. I understand that in the house where you grew up, there was a door with a brick wall behind it.
We did. We had that door. It's pretty odd thinking of it now because everything, of course, has changed. But in England in circa 1965, because my parents couldn't afford a nice little modern two-up, two-down house, they wound up buying half of an enormous manor house with grounds and stuff, which I still find quite astonishing. And we bought the servants' quarters of a big old house, and they divided the house as best they could, which was fairly regular, except for one room. And that one room, which used to have a servant's door on the servant's side of the house and the aristocrat's door for the master of the house to come in through, so they just bricked up the master's door. And I used to go and open it and look at the bricks. And sometimes I'd walk very, very slowly over to it, facing the other way, and then I'd grab the door, and then I'd open it very fast just to see if it was still bricks. And it always was bricks. But I dream sometimes of opening that door and going through it. And when I came to write Coraline, the idea of that door it's that sudden moment where you realize something has genuinely haunted you for over 20 years, since you were a child. And I thought I wanted to put the door in, and I wanted to put whatever was on the other side of it in. But I think it's very strange. One of the odd things about Coraline is it's incredibly personal for me. Apart from that door, I actually set it in the house that we were living in at the time that I began it, which was an apartment, a flat, in a big old house in a town called Nutley in England. And I peopled it with people from my past. The two elderly theatrical ladies downstairs, for example, were based on an elocution teacher I had as a boy, and her friend, and she was always surrounded by these little Scotty dogs, and given to magnificent pronouncements and calling absolutely everybody Lovey. How are you doing, Lovey? Oh, back when I trod the boars, you know. And I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to put her in? So she was another little bit of my childhood that I put into the book.
I also gleaned these small details. My thanks to the Glasgow Herald for this. That also says in that same article that when you were a boy, you dreamed about going home from school one day to find out your parents had moved without telling you.
Well, I think that's the kind of thing that if you have any kind of imagination at all, you will happily sit there during a boring geography lesson and scare yourself silly with. You know, you sort of start from, okay, what would happen if I went home from school today and my parents had moved, and they'd forgotten to tell me. I never thought, what if they'd moved maliciously? I just thought, well, they're busy people. It might have slipped their minds. So I'd imagine getting home to an empty house. And then I'd think, well, what if other people had moved in? And then, of course, I'd follow that one even further, as one does when one's sort of 10 or 11, and I'd think, well, what would happen if other people had moved in who looked exactly like my parents, but I couldn't tell? How would I know that my parents have been replaced by people who looked exactly like them? And I'd start to just sort of ponder this and spook myself and daydream, because I like daydreaming. And back then they used to tell me not to. They'd say, don't daydream, don't make stuff up.
That made it even more appealing, no doubt.
Well, these days, of course, that's how I make my entire living, sort of a wonderful combination of daydreaming and making stuff up.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with someone else. We have a caller here. This is also someone in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My name is Ryan Chester, and I just wanted to share my experience. I think it's a phenomenal idea for a book, and I can't wait to read Caroline. It just sounds amazing. And my mother used to do exactly, it sounds like, what the topic of this book is, and when I was around 8 or 9 years old, she used to tell me stories that her and my father were not really my real parents, that they were somebody else, and in fact that they were aliens. And it was a phenomenal story for me. I absolutely loved it. And now anytime I want to torture my mother, I mention this, and she gets very embarrassed.
Was she, and no doubt, perhaps I should ask that these stories were told to you for your amusement, or was this sort of torture?
Stories.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yes. No, kids have, I mean, I think, Ryan, one thing that fascinates me always is adults who often seem to have huge problems distinguishing fact from fiction tend to assume that kids have the same problems. And in fact, kids are wonderful at telling the difference between fact and fiction. They don't really have those problems, and they're capable of believing lots of different things in lots of different ways, which I've always enjoyed. I mean, on the one hand, you can quite happily believe and chill yourself and thrill yourself and laugh and with the idea that, you know, your parents were now aliens who replaced your alien parents, and on the other hand, you also know that they're not. Kids are great at doing that. It's adults who burn Harry Potter books because they're scared of witchcraft.
Right, exactly.
Kids know it's made up.
Well, thanks for the call.
Excellent. Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. And again, other people who are listening, if you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, novelist Neil Gaiman, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I do find it interesting that adult readers would, given the fact that they're that the fantasy horror genre is so full, there are so many books of that variety that you shouldn't be able to find plenty of books to read if that's what you want to read, would actually be drawn to and reading books that were written for young readers.
Well, I think what readers always hunt down, good readers always hunt down something that's different, something they can't get elsewhere. The Lemony Snicket books, most readers go for those, adult readers go for those, because you have this wonderful mock Victorian tone of voice. You have these perils of Pauline, travails of the Baudelaire children, and you have an awful lot of knowing stuff that's aimed at adults, and they're funny. Caroline, I mean, one thing that we haven't actually mentioned is that it's a very funny book. There are strange little jokes going all the way through. And often, at the same time as it's being scary, it's being funny. But the point about it, I think, from an adult perspective, is that you're reading a story you wouldn't find elsewhere. Nobody's going to go, well, there are lots of books in the horror section of a bookshop, and there are Stephen King novels I haven't yet read, therefore I'm not going to read Caroline. Adults read it very often, either because they've read something else by me and they enjoyed it, or because they've heard good things about it, or because in many cases they've read excellent reviews of it, and they pick it up. And then they pass it on to kids, and often kids pass it on to adults. We're getting a wonderful... It's interesting. We used to be, I think... I used to be much more worried about literacy than I am right now. I think the current... Talking to librarians, finding out that kids are just reading more, which I think is just great. And anything that gets kids to read is great. And anything that gets adults to read along with those kids and to get involved in the learning process and the reading process is a wonderful thing. I actually read to my 8-year-old daughter every night. And we'll take, it's just sort of 35, 40 minutes out of life and read a couple of chapters of a book to her. And I sometimes think that's the best quality time that I get during the day. It's just those 40 minutes.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Neil Gaiman, author of American Gods, Neverwhere, Stardust, other writings. He is author of a newly published, relatively newly published book for, sort of intended for young readers, but one that seems to be interesting. People of all ages, Coraline is the title, C-O-R-A-L-I-N-E, which a little earlier in the interview he explained actually started out as a typo, started out as Caroline, but he liked it so much he kept the name, and that is the title of the book. It's published by HarperCollins and is in bookstores now if you want to read it. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-WYLL, toll-free 800-222-WYLL. It strikes me that she, this character is a kind of a child that we see in literature, and I imagine probably a lot of children can identify with, because they're trying to make their way in this world peopled by adults and who are busy with their own lives, and sometimes it seems too busy for children. They don't quite get them somehow. Many of the adults in this book can't even get her name right. So obviously she feels a little bit at a loss.
I think all children at some point or other have to experience that. You are born into a world populated by giants who never stop to explain the rules to you. You know, you wind up essentially slightly powerless and waging, if not guerrilla warfare, at least anything you get, anything you understand of the world you're in, you had to go and find out for yourself. You have to figure stuff out for yourself. And you have to maneuver for yourself. So, and I wanted to try and write something that reflected not only the powerlessness that you wind up in this world of giants, but also how you can get power as a child, and that you are not powerless. So all of those things were part of what I was trying to do and trying to say. And one of the...
Yes, there's an awful lot of she's... It takes place, I gather this takes place in the summer, or perhaps near the end of the summer, so she's not in school and she has time on her hands and she's bored, and hence the exploring, and it seems to be there's a lot of other, the adults sort of, they're just too busy, and there's a lot of run along and find something to amuse yourself, sweetheart. I'm kind of busy right now. Can you just go and buzz off?
Yep, no, I mean, the thing is, speaking as somebody who spent much of his life working from home, writing books and writing comics and writing movies, you know, I would very often have to say to children coming in and saying, you know, why don't you stop that and come and play with me? And I say, well, can't actually. I have to work. That's how you eat. And they were never convinced. And much of the time I was never convinced either, which may be another reason why I wrote the book. Just to remind parents of, partly to remind parents that it is a wise thing to do, to take off that time. And also to remind children that there are worse things than having people around who do love you but don't pay as much attention to you as they ought. Because there are people who may pay attention to you who don't necessarily mean you well.
Hmm. One of the things I was just interested in having you talk a little bit about, something a little bit different, and that is about the what is now being called the graphic novel, which some people would say was a comic book. And there may be important differences between the two. And I don't necessarily, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with comic books, actually. But I'm interested in your interest in that form and what about graphic novels you find interesting, satisfying.
I think graphic novels is a publishing category. Comics is a medium. You know, comics are what you're working in. When they get collected together and are for sale in bookshops rather than in the comic stores, then I think at that point you may as well call them graphic novels. It's probably a bit like calling a hooker a lady of the evening, but it works as a publishing category. I mean, my fascination with them initially was just that I felt that there was so much one could do in comics, and that their potential was so hugely untapped. When I started writing comics in the 80s, you just started to get a few writers, people like Alan Moore, Frank Miller, who started to explore in mainstream comics some of the territory that they could go into. And over the last 100 years, you've had some wonderful writers in comics, people like Will Eisner or George Harriman. But it seemed to me that there were vast vistas that nobody had gone into. So when I wrote Sandman, which took about 8 years, I think, to write, it ran 75 issues, about 2,000 pages, and it's really one big story. And I wanted to see whether one could get as much power, as much intelligence into a comic as one could into any other mainstream fiction, and if one could also take advantage of the things that made comics comics. For example, on a page, I have no real control on a page of prose on whether somebody, if your attention lapses and your eye just sort of drifts down to the next point that somebody starts speaking. In a comic, I do. I can pretty much ensure that you're going to read every word that I write and understand every picture, and that the pictures and the words can work together. So that's one of the exciting things for me on comics. Hmm.
The illustrator, that same illustrator, also did illustrations for Coraline?
Well, yes, actually. Dave McKean, who did the illustrations for Coraline, painted the covers of all of the Sandman books and all of the Sandman comics. And he also did several graphic novels together. Signal to Noise was one. Mr. Punch was another. It was another story about childhood, although this time it was very much a story for adults. And Dave is a filmmaker and painter and so forth. And I sent him, he was one of the very first people I actually sent Coraline to, not as a potential illustrator, but because he had an 8-year-old daughter. And I said, here, read it to Yolanda and tell me what she thinks. So Dave read it to her, and he phoned me back up, and he said, well, he said it's her favorite book. And she's making me, it's her birthday next week, and she's making me draw an invitation to her birthday party based on Coraline. So he drew the picture of the little mouse orchestra at the very, very end of the book, and that was what went out to all of these little girls. And he sent a copy to me, and when I saw it, I knew that he had to illustrate the book, and was so pleased that he did. This wonderful, strange little spiky style.
Mm-hmm. I think that they make a very nice compliment to the very nice.
It really do. It's very odd. In England, they don't have the illustrations. They actually left them out because they were worried that kids wouldn't want an illustrated book, and that kids would think it somehow too childish to have a book with illustrations. And on the other hand, they've been having a lot of adults complaining that they really wanted the Dave McKean illustrations. So now we're in the peculiar position in England of when they go into paperback, they're probably going to be doing two editions, one aimed at children, with a cover aimed at children, and one aimed for adults, and the adult one will have the pictures in.
That's very interesting. One would think that it would be the other way around.
One definitely would have thought it would have been the other way around. I was enormously amused when they explained to me what they were doing. Hmm.
What is, you think, I think that there is a, within the field of fantasy writing, and there are probably other sorts of labels one might put on it, and people have been writing this kind of stuff for a long, long time. What is it, you think, the fascination with the idea that there are forces still to be found at work in nature and in the world that are older than anything that we know, that are prehistoric, that are pre-literate, and that they're still out there, and in some cases they jump out at us.
And they may not mean us well.
And they definitely may not mean us well.
I don't know. I'd love to speculate on the cause of it. As a writer, I tend much more toward the pragmatic on things like that. It's sort of like, you know, a cook may not understand why adding the salt to the dough makes the bread work in a way that it wouldn't work if you didn't add a little salt, but you know to add the salt. I'm just always fascinated by the fact that it works in fiction. Possibly because as children we are surrounded by people who've been around for much, much longer. But I don't think it's just that. There is an uncanny rightness to it. There is a feeling that, yes, this is the way the world works. And I think that's probably the best explanation I can come up with. It doesn't really feel like one of those things that's a metaphor for something. Many things you can say, well, this means this, or this means that. In the case of the idea that there are old things around, and they've been around for a very, very long time, and as we were saying, they may not mean us well, I don't know, but it's like salt. It works.
Mm. Well, there we must stop. I certainly enjoyed Coraline and Neverwhere as well. So I want to say thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much, David.
Our guest, Neil Gaiman. You can look for his books in the bookstore, and particularly this one that we have talked about, Coraline. It's published by HarperCollins.